Blog Talk Radio.
This is a Sound Health Options Show with Richard Talk to Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Richard. We are certainly happy that you're getting some rain. We talk about that on the show often. California needs it, and we talked about it before the show. It's raining hard here, so I didn't want to mention that. I didn't want you to be too upset.
Thank you.
Thank everybody for being with us today on Blog Talk Radio. We have a most special doctor with us. Most adults are aware of the adage that females are emotional and irrational and think with their hormones and lack rational thinking and logic. You know, lots of jokes about it. Even the word hysterectomy leads to words like hysterical. So our guest is going to talk about some of the things about women's health and women's hormones, and I'm particularly interested in what she's going to say about how our environment influences our hormones. We have a few announcements, and then we'll go right to our guest. We are simultaneously broadcasting from Blog Talk Radio, 347-850-1407 is that phone number for the audio portion of the show. And then I'm over here at WebEx with a video portion, and people are looking at our announcement for the show. We've titled it, Maintaining Women's Health in a Toxic World. So we want everybody to be able to either listen or watch, and right after the show, the audio will be up, and it'll take me about an hour or so to edit the video, and we'll have that up and running for you. We're coming to you from the studios of Sound Health and the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology. We're a registered 501c3 nonprofit, the largest alternative research center in Ohio, as far as we know. And what we do is put a microphone in front of someone's face. We take a vocal sample, and from that, we have learned that people with similar issues have similar, if not identical, vocal anomalies. We haven't talked about our projects for a while, but one of them we did was with the U.S. Army that led us to develop software for PTSD that we have been giving away to people, and we are going to be giving away a software during this session also. It's called The New Woman, and we were asked to develop it so that women could identify some of the struggles their hormones might be having if they were looking at the possibility of cancer or cancer in their family. So we'll be doing a drawing right after the show, and we'll announce that on Monday.
We have the keynote, which is always exciting. I want to let people know, back to the replay, that for people who are listening at Blog Talk Radio and want to see WebEx, or the people at WebEx who want to hear the Blog Talk Radio feed, you can find all that at soundhealthoptions.com. Click on the radio tab, and then for today, click on Blog Talk Radio, and down there on the right-hand side, it'll show you the link to get to WebEx, and just click on that, and you'll join Sherry's amazing chat fest over at the chat room over there. It's really quite active during the show, and you'll be able to see the things that we're talking about. And for those that like to listen to the show through Blog Talk Radio, you can also call in there at 347-850-1407. or on that same page, you'll be able to see the link to join the chat over there. And then after the show, about 15 minutes or so, there's a player, I believe, on the Blog Talk Radio tab. Again, Sound Health Options, then Radio, then Blog Talk Radio. You'll find a little box at the lower right-hand side of that page that has the player for the last five shows that we've done, and the audio for the show usually is there within about 10 or 15 minutes.
That's great. Richard, did you read the keynote for today?
I didn't. I was busy reading Dr. Gersh's papers. I got deep. Oh, no, I didn't. But I know it's going to apply. I love the keynote. It's an amazing thing that Sherry does with the keynote. It always applies that somebody, you know, the day before or something or earlier in the week has said, what about the thing and the stuff that's going on? And then Sherry comes up with this amazing keynote, this reading of the, you know, an actual, you know, computer takes in information from the acoustics coming from the planets, the cosmos, and gives us this, you know, stunningly wonderful keynote.
We're putting up an article about the gravitational waves that have come in, and they've finally been able to measure them. We've been talking about that for years here. So we've got a little bit about that. And also, we found a way for people to do a short exercise to put them into theta for self-healing. So we've put up that article also under Keynote. And there is a new section under Keynote, in the news. It's called New Articles. We put up five new articles for you this week. One about the work we've done with fibromyalgia and the relief of pain. One about frequency as an intrinsic healing modality. One about the theta waves. We just showed you that article. Another one about Larry Trevieri, who was the editor of Burton Goldberg's Alternative Medicine, wrote an article about us, so we put that up for you, The Leading Edge of Health and Healing. And then we've got a couple of articles about the Parkinson's research that we've been doing, and one in particular about Robin Williams. So I'm hoping that'll be a new section. We can keep these articles going. We have another one coming up about gout, and then one about shingles and what we've done with that with low frequency sound. We have another short announcement. We have an upcoming 5-day class about cholesterol, and our guest is going to be talking to us about the importance of cholesterol as it relates to hormones. Do you have any other announcements, Richard?
I'll just put a footnote in. I was going to try and resist this, but it keeps developing, so I have to put a note in here having to do with this government versus Apple computers. And the more I listen to the tech community talk about it, it's really becoming more evident that really if they wanted to figure this out, really what they sort of the bottom line, the joke line is, hey, FBI, Apple computer is not your IT department. And what that means is that the government, if they want this kind of access to, you know, if they want to create the ability to break into phones through our privacy, through our right to privacy, that they really could develop the technology themselves. They shouldn't be going to each manufacturer and saying, you need to give us this. No. You know, the idea is that the companies are making the phones as secure as they can to have, you know, everything from our medical records to our, you know, credit cards and everything else on the planet are becoming more and more prevalent on our phones. We have a right to privacy. If they want to break into that, it can be done. They can invest the money into people that have that ability, like hackers. Hackers for hire. Professionals who know how to do that. And then they can, you know, do what they want. But the idea of building in a back door, as I keep saying, a back door is a back door for everybody. So we just have to be really careful about that. I know this doesn't apply to this, but it just is such a big deal that it's really, you know, our medical records can be on our phones. That's how I'll tie it in. That's my announcement.
That's an incredible ongoing fight for freedom. We do welcome audience questions. We have one already. Do you have to be present to be included in the drawing for the New Woman software? Yes, you do. Okay, Richard, I think we're ready to bring in our guest.
Okay, great. I know this is going to be fun. Dr. Felice L. Gersh is a board-certified OB-GYN and a medical director of the Integrative Medical Group of Irvine, California. She's an award-winning physician and renowned national speaker on ovarian health, environmental toxins, and other important issues affecting women of all ages. Dr. Gersh is one of the small handful of board-certified OB-GYNs who have graduated from the prestigious Fellowship in Integrative Medicine at the University of Arizona School of Medicine, founded by Dr. Andrew Weil. Dr. Gersh recognized the underlying fallacy of conventional medicine, which is that we humans have the capability to micromanage the incredible complexity of human being. Although pharmaceuticals can be life-saving, they can have serious other effect potential. Dr. Gersh's goal is to use pharmaceuticals when truly needed while working in collaboration with a patient to address the root causes of the problem. At Dr. Gersh's Integrative Medical Group site, she says, "At our practice, we have a single focus, making you feel better so that you can enjoy your life to the fullest." I thought that's a great motto. I'd go see her. Good morning, Dr. Gersh.
Good morning. I actually do see some of my patients' husbands because they don't know where to turn, but mostly I see women. But yes, this is a fantastic opportunity. I love sharing with people who are totally engaged in their health and want to learn more. So I am so thrilled that you invited me to join you this morning, or afternoon, or wherever you guys are.
Right, we're all over the place.
Right, exactly.
My opening question to you is, what was the aha moment? This is sort of, I'm going to make two statements and then there's a question in the statement. So what was the aha moment that took you from practicing as a board-certified OBGYN, which is not that, it's not that you've stopped that, but it isn't like you didn't have enough education from acquiring that degree, for goodness sakes. Then you decided to go back and do the fellowship in integrative medicine at the University of Integrative Medicine, founded by Andrew Weil. Was there an aha moment, or was it just you had been in practice for a number of years doing OBGYN, and then you added this to it, to the whole mix? Was there an aha moment, or was it just sort of like you were frustrated with what was happening and you felt, oh, there's another possibility?
Well, it was a blend. I've always been interested in various forms of healing that went beyond just surgery and pharmaceuticals. And as part of my practice, I've had a Chinese medicine practitioner who did Chinese herbals and acupuncture. I've had biofeedback and nutritionists and cognitive behavioral therapists in my practice for close to the last 20 years. But I myself had no specific training in anything beyond what was, I will call, the conventional Western approach to medicine. So my aha process really occurred after I stopped doing obstetrics, which I think allowed me to get a little bit more sleep because I had major circadian rhythm dysfunction from all those phone calls and running around delivering babies in the middle of the night. So after I stopped doing obstetrics, which I'd done for almost 25 years, and it was just time for me to take care of myself a little bit and get some rest, I actually had all the parade of pharmaceutical reps who came through my office, I had them actually had to I required that they went through their studies with me and show me exactly how they got their drug approved and what exactly it did. And I was horrified, actually, when I looked at the data and I saw how they skewed the statistics to make certain drugs that had very minimal impact look like they actually had more because of the way they did their graphs. You know, they took something that would be 0.1, but they broke it into such small little pieces that it looked like on a piece of paper like it was really significant. But when you looked at the data, it was really, really marginal. And I looked at some of the pharmaceuticals. Particularly, I remember being with a rep who was showing me that a drug that was for overactive bladder over the course of 24 hours that statistically a woman would go to the bathroom one time less. And it's like, you're going to take a drug that has all these potential side effects, constipation and dementia and all these other things, so that you go to the bathroom one time less? I think that is not really a benefit. And then I started looking at more and more what I had just taken as really, you know, a given, that whatever I was told, I said, well, they wouldn't be allowing this. The FDA wouldn't allow this on the market unless it was really useful. And then the more I looked at things, it was like, this is not really that useful, and it doesn't address anything but a symptom. And then I started looking at my own toolbox, and all I had was surgery, which I was very good at. I was a very prolific surgeon, and mostly it seemed like birth control pills. And then I even looked at, like, well, what the heck are birth control pills anyway, and how did they get approved? And I just felt like I didn't have enough to offer people, so I had to go, and I went on a search. I took courses with naturopathic doctors and functional medicine doctors, and I ended up looking all around for how I could really better myself to be a really more useful doctor. And I ended up in the fellowship over at the University of Arizona, and there's no looking back for me now. I feel like my toolbox and my vision of what really is health and well-being is just so dramatically expanded. It's not just treating a few symptoms. It's really, like you said, enabling a person to feel well, to be happy, to have the quality life they should. And now, you know, as you mentioned, like living in a toxic world, my challenges have just expanded exponentially in how to help people to stay well with all the challenges that they and I and all of us face every day.
It sounds like this is not a question I'd had, but as you said that, it sounds like you could just have a practice dealing with obstetric doctors because of their, I had never thought of that, their circadian rhythm has to be a mess.
Oh, yes.
Because you get a call at 2 in the morning,
terrible.
You get a call at 4 in the morning, we're having a baby now. It's not like you can schedule it like, I'm in the office at 9. I mean, that's really true. You could just have a practice dealing with obstetric doctors. That's really
well, and other funny. Doctors too. Doctors in general tend to not take care of themselves, and many of them have the entire array of problems that they're actually trying to address with their own patients, such as high levels of stress, not, you know, eating on the run, not always getting the right nutrition, not getting adequate sleep. So, you know, that old adage of doctor heal thyself is true. And, of course, among the different specialties, obstetricians are really towards the top of the disabled group as far as their circadian rhythm goes. So definitely. And there is a trend, which is not really nice for the patient, but it's better for the doctor, at least some of them, where they have what are called now laborists, where there are doctors who are stationed in hospitals to do the deliveries. But, of course, it's impersonal, and I just couldn't live with that. I'm too much of a hands-on. I'm very old-fashioned. That I feel like I have to be there for my patients. So I couldn't do that where you just sort of hand your patient off to someone they've never met to do the delivery part, because to me that's sort of like, you know, like you're Moses. You never get into the promised land. You're just wandering. You never get to deliver your own patients. And that wasn't really suited to me and my personality type. So I couldn't go with the new trend anyway.
Wow, that's a different show. I was going to ask another follow-up question, but I'll start us in this direction. Before we start talking about hormones and having the estrogen conversation, can you tell us what are endocrine disruptors?
Sure. They are a very large array of chemicals. Some of them are actually intentionally put into our lives, and some of them are accidentally, you know, put into our lives that work in a whole myriad of ways. They can impact the way the hormones that our own bodies make in terms of what we call the receptor. So it's sort of like a key fitting into a lock. If you have the lock filled with the wrong key that doesn't turn the lock, but it fits into the lock, but it blocks the real key, then you're not going to open that door. So the different array of metabolic processes that should occur simply won't, because this chemical is blocking the receptor. Or the receptor may take that key, that chemical, and actually it turns, but it turns it in a way that some of the some of the receptors work, some don't, depending on the organ. And so you really get just a complete chaotic sense of the body working, and sometimes it works in one area, it works on a different organ, and that's sort of what happened, for example, with what was called hormone replacement therapy. Back in the day, like 13 years ago, when they did the study called the Women's Health Initiative, which was stopped, and then the mandate was, women should get off of hormones, they're so terrible, don't take them in menopause. But in reality, they weren't using hormones. They were using chemical endocrine disruptors, what was called, there was a equine conjugated estrogen, which is essentially the excrement of a pregnant horse. It doesn't even belong in the horse. The horse is trying to get rid of it, and then they gave it to humans, and of course that does not belong in a human body, along with medroxyprogesterone acetate, which is a chemical mimic of progesterone. It's not progesterone, but people would talk about it as if it were, but they gave it a man-made name called progestin. So it's a chemical that binds to the receptors for progesterone, but it has different effects than real progesterone. And for example, in breast tissue, in brain, in arteries, it actually blocks progesterone, so it's like taking an anti-progesterone, whereas on the uterine lining, it acts as if it were progesterone, so it blocks the action of the estrogen. So it reduces the risk of proliferation or uterine cancer from taking estrogen, but it actually blocks the beneficial effects of progesterone in the brain, on the breast, in the arteries. So it increases things like dementia and heart attacks and strokes and breast cancer. But unfortunately, I call it the evil twin. It's like the bad deeds of these chemical endocrine disruptors, which are masquerading as hormones and actually peddled by pharmaceutical companies, then give real hormones a bad name. And it's just been criminal, really, the way women have suffered because they have been brainwashed into thinking that real hormones are evil. That when a woman gets to a certain age, which could be 40 in some women or 55 in another, and they hit menopause, that somehow hormones become evil and give them heart attacks and strokes and dementia and cancer, when of course real hormones don't do that. It's the chemical endocrine disruptors. In terms of other than like pharmaceuticals, and like for example, another drug that is not recognized as an endocrine disruptor is the drug metformin. And in fact, a researcher in Wisconsin found that, as some of you may know, our water treatment plants were never designed to get rid of pharmaceuticals. They were designed to help get rid of toxic bacteria. So when people put their pharmaceuticals in the toilet, or they wash them down the drain, or they even excrete them, these pharmaceuticals are not treated by the wastewater treatment plants, and they end up in our rivers and then ultimately in our lakes and everywhere in our oceans. So a researcher in Wisconsin was noticing that the fish and the wildlife were changing gender and having all kinds of abnormalities of their genitalia, and these are like the wildlife. And so she actually did a test and found out it was the metformin. There are so many people now with diabetes and prediabetes on that medication that it was just really polluting the rivers in Wisconsin and actually impacting on the sexual function and the sexuality and the sexual organs of the wildlife. So metformin now is actually classified as an endocrine disruptor, which doesn't mean that no one should take it, but you know, when they've done studies looking at lifestyle changes versus metformin, lifestyle ran rings around metformin and did much better. So, of course, like in my practice, I always try to do lifestyle changes. In almost every case, they outperform the pharmaceutical, but most doctors are told, well, patients will never change, so just give them the drug. But I know that isn't true. Other things that are out there that are endocrine disruptors are things in people's cosmetics, in women's cosmetics, things that are called phthalates. They are the things that make things smell like flowery scents and so on. Years and years ago, when something smelled good, it was because they put real rose petals in, or flower geraniums or plants, and now they use chemical scents, which are actually quite toxic. You never want to do plug-ins that have scents. You really want to never use, the only scents you should ever use are from real plants, like essential, organic essential oils, you know, like you can get them, and they're very inexpensive. And so you have to look at your personal care products. We only use organic products, and you can make your own a lot of times, too, using like organic olive oil, shea butter, coconut oil, and then putting in a little bit of essential oils, and you can have your own cosmetics, or there are other brands that are really organic that are wonderful. We sell some of those. In addition, things that are from plastic, like bisphenol A, and beware, a lot of plastic water bottles that now say BPA-free, what they contain is BPS, which is a substitute, which turns out to be as or more toxic and an endocrine disruptor, which not only impacts the receptors, but also the production of hormones as well. So they interfere with the production, the degradation, and the receptors of hormones, creating really chaos in the body, which hormones, what they are, it's important to know what is a hormone, what's the purpose. A hormone is a little chemical that's made in the body that acts as an information messenger. So hormones travel around the body and deliver important pieces of information. And this information is delivered typically, most of them work, like, for example, estrogen, it has three types of receptors, two of which work in the DNA to cause what's called gene transcription. So it actually causes the gene to become transcribed, and that results in the production of a protein, and that protein then creates an effect. So hormones are really the way that the body, the different organs in the body know what to do. It's about delivering information. So when you have endocrine disruptors, the information becomes jumbled. So it's like the Tower of Babel, and the different organs don't know what to do when these endocrine disruptors get into the act. They really don't know what to do, so they often do the wrong things. And what happens is these endocrine disruptors, when they get on the receptors, sometimes they will cause the wrong gene on a chromosome to be transcribed. So the wrong protein is produced, delivering the completely wrong message, and the wrong activity of the cell then happens. And that's what they call gene expression or epigenetics. And that's how chemicals like these endocrine disruptors can alter the very foundational ways that the body functions by causing the wrong genes to become turned on, creating just really horrible chaotic effects in the body. And when these endocrine disruptors are present during pregnancy or during the early stages of childhood when the brain is being developed, the actual brain, which requires these pieces of information, particularly estrogen, is very important for brain development in utero and in early childhood. The brain simply doesn't develop properly, and we don't know how to fix that. You get one chance to make the brain correctly. Some things are fixable, and some things are not. We don't know how to really fix a brain that wasn't connected right, with the right connectivity and the right receptors functioning. And so that's part of why we have such an epidemic now of children with difficulty with behaviors and attention and learning and increase in autism. Of course, it's even more complicated than that. But it's really critical when women are pregnant to do everything possible to avoid chemicals. And one of the things that came out was the government would say, oh, the level of bisphenol A is really insignificant. It's below the threshold that's in this woman. Well, it turns out that the BPA, it actually concentrates in the fetus. So the level in the mother is a fraction of the level in the fetus, which actually concentrates and gets a much, much higher level of the bisphenol A, this endocrine disruptor. So, and every single one of us has these chemicals in us. It's like 100%. For example, the chemicals that were used in nonstick pans that were, you know, the Teflon, virtually that's the perfluorinated carbons. We now know that virtually 100% of us have this. Almost close to 100% of us have DDT, and that's been banned for decades. But it's what we call a persistent organic pollutant. It takes decades for that stuff to disappear. And in fact, they're finding levels of these persistent organic pollutants in the Great Lakes. And one of the things that's interesting with these drugs, these chemicals, is that they are now labeled, about a decade ago, they were given a label, they're called obesogens. And as we all know, that 70% of people in this country now are overweight or obese, and everyone keeps thinking, oh, we know, everyone's like a lazy bum, we're, you know, nobody can eat right. But the reality is that human nature hasn't changed in the last 30 years. What has changed is the food and the environment. And now when we eat, like if you eat farmed salmon, you're getting a heavy dose of what are called PCBs. And these are persistent organic pollutants that actually are poison to your mitochondria, the little energy factories of cells. And so you can't burn fat properly, but you're very good at storing fat, but you can't burn it because your mitochondria, the energy burning factories of the cells, are actually poisoned. That's why they call them obesogens, and now they're called diabesogens. And they did a study of men who ate the fish that they caught, who were sport fishermen, and they were fishing in the Great Lakes, and they ate their fish, which are all unfortunately polluted with these chemicals now because the factories just ran the stuff into the lakes. And they found that the men who ate the fish had twice the incidence of diabetes as matched men who didn't eat the fish. So I personally believe human beings are not just a bunch of good-for-nothings. They won't eat any good food. They don't want to move. The reality is that people are tired because they can't burn their fat. So it's like living in a sea of fat, but you can't turn it into energy. So a lot of times overweight people are very tired. So it's not like they don't want to move. They just don't have the energy. And they actually did an interesting study where they took children and they said, you know what, the problem with these children, they're all getting fat. So they're all just, you know, looking at television when they come home from school. And that's the problem. So they took the children and took them all to a park. Wouldn't let them watch TV. And put them in the park with all kinds of balls that they could play with, and there were swings and all the different playground equipment. And they said, here, kids, go have fun. And the kids all just sat on the grass. They were too tired. It's not that the kids would just want to watch television. It's that they really, they don't have energy. Like children should have energy. But they're tired because their mitochondria don't burn fat, so they can't make energy, so they're tired. That's the difference between, you know, in the past, young people and old people. Old people don't have the capability of creating energy as well as young people. So you go to, in the old days, you go to a park, and all the old people would be sitting on the bench, and all the young people would be playing, running around. But now, a lot of the young people are tired, too, because they can't make energy, so they're just sitting. So it's very complex. It's not just take away the TV. Of course, that is an issue. But it's really that our bodies are not working the way they used to work. And it's because of these ubiquitous chemicals that are, they include heavy metals and then the, like the Teflons. This, in California, for example, we have the highest levels, blood levels of flame retardants in our bodies of any other state, because way back in his first round as the governor, Jerry Brown wanted to protect us all. So he passed the most stringent laws requiring fire retardants in everything. So now we put fire retardants. Well, it turns out that these are endocrine disruptors and very toxic chemicals, and they get into dust. They create a dust, and that's why it's very important to dust your house and get a really good vacuum system, because little children, they get into the dust, and these little children are eating the dust, which is just loaded with these chemicals from flame retardants, which are carcinogens as well as endocrine disruptors. So it's really important to get rid of the dust as best you can. But it's just a very challenging world that we live in. I was at an environmental medicine conference last weekend in San Diego, where I also spoke. And one of the world-renowned people, the researchers on GMO foods, were there. And I thought I knew a lot about GMO foods, but I learned a lot. And now I'm going to do everything. I've always tried, but I'm going to try even harder to not have any GMO food in my life. It turns out that what was called the active ingredient in Roundup Ready food, Roundup Ready means that the GMO foods, they're genetically modified plants to allow them to tolerate heavy, heavy doses of a toxic herbicide to kill weeds and not kill the plant that you're then supposed to eat. The problem is the stuff that they're pouring on the plant is very bad for us. It's not good for us to eat. And it turns out that the active ingredient that's listed is glyphosate, which is both an endocrine disruptor. It's actually a carcinogen. It's very, very toxic. It kills the good bacteria in our gut, which is really another whole giant hour at least, called the microbiome, which is the bacteria in our GI tract, which is actually now known as the hidden critical organ that actually regulates just about every single thing in our body, our metabolism, our brain function, our cognition, our mood, our immune systems. And this stuff in GMO foods called glyphosate actually kills out our good bacteria. But it's even worse. It turns out that the ingredients that are listed that are so-called inert ingredients are as, if not more toxic than the glyphosate. And these brilliant scientists had to decipher what exactly these ingredients were, because the company, Monsanto, would not disclose this because they're considered trade secrets. So they had to figure it out themselves, and when they did, they found out that they were really quite toxic. And so I hope that everyone out there knows that they should try as best they can to eat organic foods and locally grown and harvested. And that's because when you get food and it's just picked, of course, it's going to have a higher nutrient value than if it's picked and shipped and refrigerated for 8 months, you know. So unfortunately, we do have food like that. And they're actually trying to develop genetically modified apples that will never turn brown. You know, real food does rot. You know, you never want food that will never rot or turn brown, because that's not the way that nature makes food. It's like, you know, the Twinkies things where, you know, hundreds of years from now you can still open the Twinkie and it's as fresh as the day it was made. That's because it's filled with trans fat, which is poison. So, and you know, now trans fat is pretty much illegal. But for years and years we were told to eat trans fat. It's just sort of an amazing thing. So I've gone through this transformation, which I'm sure many of you out there in the audience have gone through, where you believed that whatever was sold must be safe, to now you believe that it's probably not safe and you better check it out, because you're not getting the protection that we wish we had in terms of what's on the market. A lot of things are approved to be sold and they're really, really not safe at all. And that includes, you know, even a lot of pharmaceuticals that are used, they do have a place. Like, for example, PPIs, those are the proton pump inhibitors that people take when they have like acid reflux or ulcers. Those can be life-saving, but they're only supposed to be used for 2, maybe 4 weeks. But now there are people using them for decades, and they think that stomach acid is evil. But stomach acid is actually essential to digestion. And when you don't have stomach acid, you can't make nitric oxide, which is essential for the health of your arteries, and you get overgrowth of bacteria in your small intestine, which we call SIBO, small intestinal bowel overgrowth, and then you can't properly digest and absorb your nutrients, and you have nutrient deficiencies. And so you can't absorb, for example, magnesium, so you're more prone to muscle cramps and cardiac arrhythmias. So there's a place for many, many pharmaceuticals. The problem is they're not really designed to be used for years and even decades, and recognize they're never tested for more than usually a few months at a time. And they're also never tested in combination with other drugs. So we never know what happens when you combine all these things together. And my practice and myself is we try to enable the human body to have what it needs, the right nutrients, the right sleep. We work with circadian rhythms, and also we didn't even talk about electromagnetic radiation, which is a big factor for a lot of people. So I recommend earthing, where if possible you put your bare feet on the earth, the grass, the sand, but hopefully not a golf course that's full of pesticide. And you have to pick the right grass to walk in now. It's really a challenge in this world. But and you can also buy surrogate earth, you know, and you can actually plug in and have a surrogate. And what that does is it reduces the free radicals that are caused by the excessive radiation, and that creates oxidative stress, which, of course, is then harmful to the body in many, many ways. And so I know there's just so much to talk about, and so we're sort of jumping around, but I think the sort of feel is that it's complex living in our planet, and you have to make really careful decisions about what you eat and what products you buy and what you put on your body and the kind of cookware you cook with, and don't wrap your food in plastic because it all leaches out. So we have to make the best decisions we can. I mean, think about the people in Flint, Michigan. They were given water that was so incredibly toxic, and it's really hard. You know, what do you do when the water out of your tap is not really optimal? I do recommend people try to get water purification, air filters for their homes and such, but there's just so much we can do. So we all have to make the best choices we can and become really advocates and really work to with the local organizations in your community to try to get clean water and work to get good food and so forth. So I hope everyone becomes an activist of some sort to try to help to save our Earth from all the pollution and all the toxins that we're facing at this time.
Dr. Gersh, we have a couple of questions from the audience. One is about, you've mentioned that the hormones and cholesterol and how important that is. What do you think about hormones and statins?
Well, I am not at all an advocate for statins. There are just a very few people that could benefit. For example, say a man who just had a heart attack, perhaps that, or is very unstable with very advanced severe chest pain and very advanced cardiovascular disease. But it's a very, very small number of people. There's almost no place for statins in women. There's this, if you talk about primary prevention, that means trying to prevent the first heart attack or stroke. They have, when they do drug studies, what is called number needed to treat. That's how many people would take a drug for one person to benefit. Now, a lot of people think that everyone benefits when they take a drug, but that's actually very far from the case. And the number needed to treat for statins for women for primary prevention is in the hundreds. So you have to give a few hundred women the drug for one woman to benefit. But what about the negatives? Well, we now know that statins prevent the body from making CoQ10. Now, CoQ10 is a critical coenzyme in the production of energy in those little energy factories I mentioned called mitochondria. This is what is called the electron transport chain, and it's a where the electrons go down this line and then create energy. And in order for that to happen, it's essential that CoQ10 be present. And that is blocked because the way that statins work is they block the body's production of cholesterol, and simultaneously, it's a similar pathway, it blocks the body's production of CoQ10. So that is a very big problem. As well, it increases dementia in women and diabetes in women, and that's hardly something that we want, dementia and diabetes. And it doesn't really prevent heart attacks or strokes, that's the thing. And cholesterol, when people do have very high cholesterol, or they have a lot of what we call oxidized LDL. Remember the old thing of LDL is bad cholesterol, HDL is good. That's been trashed, okay? Both LDL and HDL are both essential. If you have zero LDL, you're dead. If you have zero cholesterol, you're dead. Cholesterol is essential to making steroid hormones. Of course, the sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, and others, DHEA and so on, they're all steroids. And, of course, cortisol is a steroid hormone. And they're essential to life. Cholesterol is also very critical to the cell membrane and part of brain health. So in elderly people, for example, low cholesterol is associated with higher mortality than is high cholesterol. But we don't want oxidized cholesterol, oxidized LDL, because that's the type that gets into artery walls and can create plaque and unstable plaque. So when people have abnormal lipid profiles and they look at particles, not just the old-fashioned lipid panel, that's of almost no value. In fact, half of people who have heart attacks have so-called completely normal lipid panels. The cholesterol is normal. So they're not worthwhile. You need to get the high-end panels from companies like the Cleveland Heart Lab and such that really do inflammation markers, and they look at the different particle sizes, because the old-fashioned lipid cholesterol panels are really almost completely useless. But when people do have abnormalities with their lipids and cholesterol, that is not the problem. that is the sign of a problem, and you have to look at why that's happening. So you have to go much deeper, like peeling the layers of the onion. For example, if someone has a headache and they have a brain tumor, the headache is a sign that there's a problem. You really got to go below that. That's not the end, is not to give someone, you know, an aspirin for their headache if they have a brain tumor. So if someone has really abnormal lipids, you have to look at why. One of the main reasons why people have high cholesterol problems is actually because they have low thyroid. And a lot of doctors don't know how to read thyroid panels because they look at what are called reference ranges. A reference range just means 95% of random people were within that range. That has nothing to do with what's optimal for the body. For example, a free T3, T3 is the active form of thyroid, a free T3 needs to be at least a 3.2, but the reference range will often start at a 2.0. So doctors think, oh, you have a 2.1, you're good. That is not good. And if you have levels like that, it almost always will translate into an abnormal cholesterol. So you don't want to just lower the cholesterol, you want to up the thyroid. And then you have to look at why is the thyroid low. Often it's due to autoimmunity, and then like what we call like Hashimoto's. And so then you have to look at, well, why is that? Or it could be because of endocrine disruptors that are interfering with the production of thyroid, or maybe you don't have enough iodine. For example, the vast majority of people now are iodine deficient. 100 years ago, it was recognized that people in the country weren't getting enough iodine. So they put iodine in salt. I'm sure people know that. Remember like Morton's iodized salt. Well, who's eating that nowadays? Who's like telling people to have a lot of salt? And most people, when they have salt, then that's not even the kind they have, and they don't use that in processed food. And if you're buying your own salt, most people want to have a good quality salt, more like a Himalayan sea salt. And so where's your source of iodine? The ground is pretty depleted now of iodine, so the plants don't have much, and the only place you get it then is from sea vegetables or from fish, certain kinds of fish. Well, now we're afraid to eat fish because they're all full of mercury and other toxins, and most of us are not eating lots of seaweed and kelp on a regular basis, so many of us are very deficient in iodine, so we don't make enough thyroid properly, and then we don't have enough proper cholesterol. The cholesterol is abnormal. And that's, you know, you need to get to the root cause. That's just one way that it can be. When people have high triglycerides, that's often a sign of insulin resistance and their sugar levels are too high. So you got to look at what's going on with that. So it's always complex, and it's never, the solution is never just give a statin. I can tell you that. Not in my world, not the way I practice.
Well, wow. And it actually leads me to want to talk about your, in our last 10 or 15 minutes here, really to talk about this wonderful paper that's available at your website, and I'll put that in both chats, the When Puberty Never Ends, Your Guide to Taming the Flames of PCOS, because everything that you've talked about is in that realm of dealing with the polycystic ovarian syndrome. And so talk to us about that, you know, that arena. Everything that you've said piles right into here, like, and that's kind of what we talked about before the show. It's like, this is amazing, this cascade of things that have to, and all this pollution and stuff that's invading us. Now how do we get to the other side and really tame the flames of PCOS?
Right. Well, I'm glad that you brought up PCOS. That's one of my special interests. I deal with, you know, all aspects of female health, which always involves some sort of hormones and endocrine disruptors. And PCOS is sort of the epitome of how things have gone, you know, wrong for all of womankind. PCOS, which stands for polycystic ovary syndrome, used to be quite uncommon. Now it is very common. Depending on who you ask, it's up to 20% or so of women have PCOS, and it's the most common endocrine dysfunction of women, the most common cause of fertility problems for women, and it really puts it all together in terms of the problems. It seems and nobody knows everything about it. It's still at the investigative stage. But in women who have a genetic predisposition, and about half of women who have PCOS have a first or second degree relative who also has PCOS. So if you have a genetic predisposition, and then it seems that if you're exposed at certain critical times in your development, in utero, early childhood, and around puberty, to bisphenol A, which is an endocrine disruptor, that this creates the setting for polycystic ovary syndrome to occur. So, in fact, we know that women with polycystic ovary syndrome are born intrinsically inflamed. Inflammation is sort of the hallmark of polycystic ovary syndrome, and it inflames in terms of their skin. That's why many have cystic acne, in their fat tissue. That's why they have so much trouble losing weight, and in their GI tracts. Many women have trouble with irritable bowel syndrome, in their brains as well. That's why many women with PCOS have depression, more anxiety, sort of more just sort of upregulated emotions. They often have inflammation in their joints. They have more arthritis, more vaginal infections, more problems with sleep, and increased incidence of autoimmune diseases, including especially thyroid. So it's really a total body state of inflammation, which is due to the fact that the receptors for estrogen never quite developed right because of the exposure at critical times with this endocrine disruptor, bisphenol A. And people don't really know much about estrogen, including most gynecologists, but estrogen is very anti-inflammatory. And what happens in women with PCOS is that their estrogen receptors are not working properly, and they're not even making estrogen quite properly because of the feedback loop that involves the brain and the whole signaling issue. Like we talked about, hormones are about information and getting the message out, and so the messages are not getting to the tissues and to the brain properly, and so the hormones are not being made the way they should be. And estrogen receptors are not responding properly, and so there's this level of inflammation that women are born with who develop PCOS. And in fact, there's a lab test that we can test in very young girls, like 5, 6, 7-year-olds, called adiponectin, which is a hormone that's made by fat tissue, but that hormone is directed by estrogen in terms of its production. And because of the improper function of estrogen, the fat tissue is not being directed properly and enough adiponectin is not being made. And adiponectin is very anti-inflammatory. So when puberty hits, the whole thing goes into real chaos because of the feedback loops and the brain isn't perceiving estrogen and it keeps putting out more signals and it makes more testosterone because estrogen is made by converting testosterone into estrogen. And the body keeps trying to make more estrogen, but in the process it keeps making more testosterone. And the adrenal glands get into the act because that's how puberty begins, is with the adrenal gland making cortisol and DHEA, which then causes the girl to put on some fat tissue, which then converts the androgen, which is DHEA, made in the adrenal gland, into estrogen, and then the estrogen goes to the brain. The brain says, oh, yes, it's time for puberty, and then the brain starts making the signals to the ovary to then make its own estrogen in the ovary. But all this signaling is not going right because the receptors are not hearing the message right. So you have this sort of discordance with the brain and the adrenal gland and the fat hormones and so on. So you end up in a situation where you keep making more fat, you keep making more DHEA, you keep making more testosterone, which gives you more acne and hair loss and more fat building up in your body. So, and the signals never shut down. So it's like puberty never ends. It just keeps going on, and the adrenal gland keeps putting out too many of its hormones trying to get puberty started, and the brain keeps putting out too many signals to make testosterone to the ovaries. And then inflammation begins, and it grows, and then the GI tract gets into the act because cortisol causes also ultimately inflammation in the GI tract. And then you get this whole problem with the GI tract, which causes more inflammation. And it just becomes like the perfect storm of all these different things going wrong, and the poor woman doesn't know what's going on because she's having anxiety, she's putting on weight, she can't lose weight even if she doesn't eat because she can't burn the fat because the signals to the fat are not working right, and the inflammation causes more insulin and resistance to glucose, and you get insulin resistance, and then that puts on more weight. and that increases the risk of diabetes. So it's obviously a very complex situation, which we can't, like, master in 5 minutes, but I just want to give, like, the impression of all the different hormone signaling systems in the body are getting the wrong message, because the foundational information which should happen didn't really happen. Now, as bad as that all sounds, there's so much we can do to help. It's not a hopeless situation at all. There are herbals that can improve the glucose transport into cells. There are herbals that can reduce inflammation. So there are diets that we can give that improve the gut health, that improve the microbiome, the health of the bacteria. And we can give diets that really lower the sugar load and increase resistant starch that can't turn into sugar, and healthy fats. So there's wonderful things that we can do with various supplements and herbals and with different dietary things, as well just working with emotions, with like meditation and so on, can lower the adrenaline and the cortisol, which are causing a lot of the problems and causing more of the push to making fat. And as well, there's even hope by giving bioidentical hormones to override the resistance of the receptors. And actually, if we start it early enough, we may even be able to reprogram the receptors and even cure PCOS. And even in later stages, we can do so much. So this is absolutely a very devastating situation, and absolutely one in which there's tremendous hope that we can do so much to reverse this. And it's not something that you can, like, fix in a day, not at all. And giving birth control pills and metformin, though it may help short-term, it's really not getting to the root cause at all. And certainly that's not my optimal choice for treating women with PCOS. But it's a combination of major lifestyle changes, exercise, which can improve the function of the mitochondria, the fat-burning little organelles in cells, working with stress, working with sleep, circadian rhythm, and possibly working with bioidentical hormones. And I have a whole protocol. So if anyone wants to contact me, I'd be happy to share my protocols. I share everything very freely, and I have all of my herbals, my supplement protocols, which I'm very happy to share with any in the audience that would like to have that information. And know that there is, although it, you know, it sounds so gloomy when I describe it, there is so much hope to do so much to reverse it and improve all of these symptoms. And I can get virtually everyone to start having regular cycles again and to get pregnant when they want to get pregnant. So although I can't always cure everyone, I can remediate the situation to give them a healthy and happy life.
Well, and even if you cannot cure, you can certainly make them be feeling better, be happier, and start that what I call the upward spiral from the downward spiral, that really you get people starting to feel even better, not perfect or not what they're really going for. If they just begin to feel better, that has such a positive effect on how everything then begins to work, because the whole body is not feeling like, oh, there's no hope. As that ray of, you know, betterness gets in there, then, oh, wow, now I really want to be doing that regular exercise. I see that the diet helping me change. It's really, you know, it's transformational.
Absolutely. The first thing is to know and really know that there is hope, because there's nothing that's more devastating than feeling hopeless. So to know that there is hope, that things can get better, and yes, it's going to include some hard work and maybe some major lifestyle changes and maybe, you know, a little pain along the way in terms of having some cravings that you have to work through and different things, but oh my gosh, there's so much hope. And just knowing that there's hope, just changing your mindset is life-altering just in itself. And because you know that the mind, the belief that you can do something is what makes it happen as well. That you can, if you have a negative attitude, then that's what will be. You know that they've done studies where they've given people purified water and then afterwards said, oh, we're sorry, we gave you something that's really bad for your heart. And they all started having chest pains, and it was just pure water. You know, so your brain is so powerful that you have the ability to override all kinds of negative things or create negative things. So it's so important to have that hope and know that it's not pretend hope, it's real hope, because there is so much that we can do for PCOS women now.
That's wonderful. I have a question from the audience about estrogen. Is there something we can do for to protect the estrogen receptor sites or to open them back up once they become sort of what I would call polluted from all these, you know, xenoestrogens and the estrogen disruptors?
Oh, absolutely.
And endocrine disruptors?
Absolutely. The first thing you have to find out is what your toxic load is. So that's sort of what we talk about in environmental medicine. It's not just one thing. It's always your toxic load. So it's like we talk about the bucket, and when your bucket of toxins is overflowing, that's when you really manifest with clinical signs and symptoms. So the first thing that you want to do is we all recognize that we all have a toxic amount of things, and we want to get that toxic load down to the level that the body can eliminate it. We do have amazing detoxification properties in our body involving primarily the liver, but also our skin and our kidneys and our lungs are all part of the detoxification pathways. So we can actually do tests, and we do this all the time. We can do a toxic effects test where we actually look at what are your levels of solvents and persistent organic pollutants, organophosphates, pesticides, phthalates, bisphenol A, and so on. We can actually measure these levels in you. We can now do a test to measure your glyphosate level. As well, we can test for heavy metals. And then we know how to help the body get rid of these things. We have detoxification programs to help people with heavy metals, with mild chelations and such. And there are ways, even over time, it can take 2, even 3 years, but some things are faster than others because the persistent organic pollutants are ones that it takes time. But we know how to help your body to get rid of these toxins so they get off the receptors. So absolutely, no one should just, everyone should know their toxic load and should know what's going on in their body, particularly if they have any problems, which almost everyone does. If you have an autoimmune disease, if you've had cancer, if you have depression, anxiety, if you have any GI symptoms, bloating, gas, constipation, diarrhea, irritable bowel syndrome, if you have insomnia, all of these things are signs of toxins. If you get crazy rashes, things of that sort. We can check. I mean, it's not just me. There are other doctors like me, too, that can check with lab tests to see what your environmental toxin exposures are, what you're carrying in your body, and then help to reduce it. And, of course, the first thing that you want to do is reduce your exposure as best you can. So, of course, you know, that's what we talked about, get air purifiers. We know that air pollution kills at least an excess of like 5.5 million people a year just from air pollution. And I'm sure many of you have seen pictures of the air, for example, in Beijing, where people walk around with masks and gas masks. And Portland, Oregon now has a toxic plume of heavy metals and other pollutants in the air in Portland, Oregon. I mean, this is really a worldwide problem of air pollution. So, you know, you want to do things that you can if you live in an area that has heavy air pollution, which is a lot of places now, to get air purifiers and such. But then, you know, the inside of a house is polluted. There's off-gassing of formaldehyde and things from particle boards and walls. So if you have a pretty good air quality, at least for an hour every day, open all your windows and try to air out your home. Try to go out, like I said, and deal with the electromagnetic radiation by walking around barefoot if you can on grass or sand, or getting surrogate earths by going to like earthing.com and getting like the pad to put under your feet. But absolutely, we can reduce the toxic load in just about anyone by explore, you know, what's going on, where are their toxic exposures, what can we do to reduce them, and how can we help their bodies to eliminate some of these toxic loads. And by giving bioidentical hormones to women who are in menopause, if something's going to occupy the receptor, let it be the real hormone, not an endocrine disruptor. So although I don't push anyone into doing it, my personal opinion is that most all women, with a few exceptions, will benefit from taking bioidentical hormones in the menopause years, because knowing what hormones do, that they're important messengers of giving information to tissues so that they know what to do. Without that, my analogy is that you have an orchestra, and when you go through menopause, the conductor, which is estrogen, simply leaves the stage. and now you have an orchestra fending for itself, which it can do for a while, but after a while, the winds and the strings don't work together anymore. And then if you have endocrine disruptors, it's like throwing in a couple of dozen two-year-olds with cymbals into that orchestra, and now you have nothing but chaos and noise. And so, you know, you really want to keep that conductor on the stage as long as possible, and that's the estrogen. That's the master of metabolic homeostasis.
It only takes one a bad cymbal play. I used to be in an orchestra. So it only takes wrong cymbal
perfect.
To, like, throw. Well, it was a long time ago, but, I mean, I was that person on the cymbal, you know, on playing the cymbal.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, there's that moment. There's always that
analogy.
Moment. There is that moment in the orchestra where the leader's looking at you because, I mean, a cellist can make a mistake, somebody else can make kind of a mistake, and it's just like in there and you it's moved quickly, but there's nothing worse than the wrong cymbals. Because once you do
there's no going back.
You can't make it like it's bad. It's terrible. It's a horrible position. We have another question from chat, and then I know that we have to close. Do you have a healthy range that you can give for TSH for a woman in her early 40s?
Yes. Now, TSH is an interesting hormone. It's made by the pituitary gland. It stands for thyroid stimulating hormone. In a perfect, pristine world, all you ever need to measure for thyroid is free T4, which is the storage form of thyroid hormone, and TSH, which is the pituitary hormone. Now, the way it works is, for people who don't know, the brain, the hypothalamus of the brain, can sense how much T4, that's also sometimes called thyroxin, how much T4 is circulating, and if there's not enough, the hypothalamus of the brain makes a little mini hormone that comes out of the hypothalamus that goes to the pituitary and tells the pituitary, hey, we need more thyroid, go put out your thyroid stimulating hormone, which will then circulate and tell, as a message, right, will tell the thyroid gland to up its production of T4. Now, T4 is actually the storage form of thyroid. So my analogy is T4 is like money in the bank. It's good to know it's there, and if you live in a cash society and you have ATM machines, whenever you need cash, you just go and you pull out your cash, and the cash is T3. So T3 is what you spend. T4 is just the reserve. So in a perfect world, the way the body was designed, the brain can tell how much T4 is around, and it just will put out TSH to make sure that T4 is produced in adequate amounts. The problem is we don't live in that perfect world anymore. T4 converts to T3. T3 is like cash in hand. So what happens if you don't have enough iodine? What happens if you have receptor problems that are not working properly? What happens if you have issues where you have, you know, autoimmunity? And, you know, so basically there are all kinds of ways now that, number one, the brain may not perceive T4 properly because of endocrine disruptors, or T4 does not get converted properly into T3. So it would be like you have plenty of money in the bank and you go to the restaurant and you buy a delicious meal, and then they say, okay, now here's the bill, pay up, and you say, well, I have a lot of money in the bank. And they say, that's nice, but we want cash. You know, go get cash. There's an ATM machine right around the corner, and you go to the ATM machine and it's broken. So you have plenty of money in the bank, like, say, T4, but you can't get cash in hand because the ATM machine is broken. So that's the problem. So if all you look at is TSH, it only reflects the T4, not the T3, because the body was designed to only monitor T4 because it was sort of understood that the brain would know when you need more T4, you'd make more T4, and T4 would automatically and perfectly be converted into T3 like cash in hand whenever it was needed. But now we have all these broken ATM machines, and we can't get our T4 converted to T3 properly a lot of the time. So what I'm telling you is I never just look at TSH anymore, because I have to look at free T3. I have to look at the whole package, because otherwise I really won't understand what's happening with the thyroid. But in terms of TSH, if you're just going to look at TSH, the optimal TSH should probably be between 1 and 2. And for sure, if it hits 3, even the Endocrine Society and the other endocrine organizations say a TSH should be under 3. And for pregnancy, depending on which organization, it should never be above 2 or 2.5. And so why should it be different for pregnancy? So in an optimal state, assuming that, you know, your T4 is converting properly to T3 and so on, if you're looking at TSH, the optimal level would be between probably a 1 and a 2. I know it's a long way to get to your answer.
No, that was great. Thank you. How do people work with you? Do they need to come to you, or can they do some things online, or can they follow your written protocols?
Oh, that's a great question.
And where do they get more information about some of the protocols you talked about, like the herbs, other possibilities?
Oh, sure. Well, can I give you my email? Or I don't know if you
can
get it to people,
sure.
Which is fine.
Yes. Yes.
So my email is F, as in Felice or Frank, F Gersh, G-E-R-S-H. So my name, F Gersh, at Integrative, M as in mother, G as in George, I as in igloo, .com. So because my clinic is Integrative Medical Group of Irvine. So it's F Gersh at integrativemgi.com. And we would be happy to send our protocols out to anyone who's interested. In terms of seeing me, of course I see patients. That's really what I do. I'm a practicing doctor, and my practice is in Irvine, California. So I'm very easy to find. In terms of, like, remote, like, the way that telemedicine is now, California has the most generous and or lenient, depending on how you want to look at it, laws regarding telemedicine. So anyone who lives in California, is a California resident, can do telemedicine with me, and I never have to see them. That's the new law in California. It's relatively new, that you can do telemedicine with anyone in California, because I'm a California licensed doctor, and I never have to see them. Isn't that interesting? But if you're in a different state, then I can't. Okay, so if you're not in California, I can't take care of you unless you come to see me in person at least a few times, you know, here and there. You have to see me. I can probably maybe get by with, like, maybe twice a year. I can't care for anybody as a real patient-doctor relationship without seeing them unless they're a California resident, in which case I never have to see them, as bizarre as that. These are the laws. I can do what we call telewellness visits, whereby, and from any state, where I can just talk to people, and the way that the law works, I can't create a chart, and I can't address them specifically, but I can talk about any topic in general terms. So if somebody, say, said, well, if somebody had PCOS, and this is kind of what they had, you know, blah, 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 give me a little bit of a general thing, what kinds of things could you suggest? And then I could give general suggestions. So I can do that, but I can't say, and tell me what your lab tests are, because that would be a specific doctor-patient relationship. This all will probably change in the next couple of years, but right now it's really sort of ridiculous the way the telemedicine laws are. I can do anything in California with any Californian, and I'm very restricted if you're not a Californian, but it means you have to see me a couple of times a year. Of course, I always prefer to see people because I'm a hands-on doctor. I like to do exams, and I like eye-to-eye contact. But with people who can't and live in California, we can Skype, and we can do all kinds of things remotely. And I can do general conversations no matter where you are.
Wonderful. I knew it was going to be a fast hour, and it was. That was really awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Gersh. That was
it was my pleasure. And any time you want, I obviously, there's so much to talk about. We do multi-day seminars. What can you say? I find the human body and trying to tackle health issues to be the most interesting thing ever. So I guess I'm an addicted person to trying to help people to be healthy. So anyone who's out there, if I can help you, that's my goal.
I completely resemble that remark. I understand completely. Thank you.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you very much. And we'll see everybody Tuesday. I know we're talking about something. I just don't know what at this moment. Any closing thoughts, Sherry?
No, it makes me want more. And I listen to Dr. Gersh's voice, and she is a natural teacher. Maybe she can create some courses around this and teach us how to take care of ourselves.
You know, that actually is on my agenda over the next year to try to do that. I have spent all my life being a doctor, and I really don't know how to do a lot of these kinds of things. But so with help, I can hopefully create maybe like webinars and programs and things that to really to help people. And I'm trying to get a little book out. I'm almost done with my first like little primer on PCOS, and I have some other things in the works. It's all a question of getting help to put it all together, you know. So that's my goal, is to try to create different formats to educate and help.
Wonderful. We look forward to that so much. Everybody have a great rest of the week, and we'll see you on Tuesday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.